Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is another Top Cal Thursday episode, and today I'm going to be talking about the first volume of Cyber Force Awakening Volume 1. This is a series that started in 2018, ran for 11 issues. 12 issues were announced. I don't think the final issue ever came out. Originally, it was supposed to run for 25 issues, so I got to think that it was sales-oriented why it stopped, but it sure was fun while it lasted, right? And Cyber Force obviously is a name that should be very familiar to fans of Top Cow. It is the project that Mark Silvestri initially launched when he left Marvel, stopped working on X-Men, and helped to found Image Comics along with Jim Lee and Todd McFarlane and Jim Valentino and Rob Liefeld and all those guys. So it is interesting to think about Cyber Force as a property because unlike Savage Dragon from Eric Larson or Spawn from Todd McFarlane, those are the two series that have continued to be published. They've continued the numbering. I think Savage Dragon's approaching 300 and Spawn has actually surpassed it already. So you kind of wonder like why were these other properties more well known? You know, Wildcats even got a cartoon. Youngblood and Liefeld, I mean, he has kind of a rabid following, so you can see why that would be a property, as well as Brigade that kind of hung around. But I feel like Cyber Force is sort of the forgotten one. And I was thinking about it the other day, trying to maybe pin down why that would be the case. Maybe it was because Silvestri didn't necessarily bite off more than he could shoot right from the start. You know, he planned on doing a four-issue miniseries, and that is, you know, initially what he did. And then it wasn't until later that they had a longer running series that ran like 35 issues and actually eventually crossed over with Wildcats. So is it the fact that first series was only four issues? It's tough to say. And if you look at a lot of the other properties online, you can find a ton of stuff, especially Spawn and Savage Dragon. Again, you can understand that them being ongoings that have lasted a long time. It's much tougher to go back and find historical stuff about Cyber Force. Like even the articles that you do find don't have as much information as some of the other properties. So you would think, why didn't this last? Why isn't there more information about it? When I say why didn't this last, I'm talking about this more recent series. Like, you know, if Spawn goes away and then comes back a couple years later, you can bet people would be jumping on it, right? And so this was planned to go 25 issues and didn't even make it. And I was disappointed. I liked the series. I thought it was interesting and it was exploring a lot of really cool modern ideas. Something I'll have to talk to Matt Hawkins or Mark Silvestri about next time I see them. I'm curious what they might have to say, because there are other properties at Top Cow that do very well. I would almost think that, you know, Witchblade and Darkness are more like well-known and valuable properties for them now than Cyber Force is. But Cyber Force is the one that kind of started it all. So I find that interesting. So to talk a little bit about this particular series, the 2018 volume of Cyber Force, Matt Hawkins went on record as talking to Mark Silvestri about it and saying that he convinced Mark to let go of some of the, in Matt's words, the more lame characters. So we don't even know in the beginning who exactly is going to show up in this new Cyber Force series. So the original characters in Cyber Force were Ballistic, Psyblade, Heatwave, Impact, Ripclaw, Striker, and Velocity. And they all had, you know, various levels of popularity. This series starts off mainly with Striker and Velocity, and then we start to see some other characters recruited later on. But in the first volume that I'm going to talk about today, it's just Striker and Velocity. And to go back and talk about that original series, we're really talking about 90s comics, kind of the epitome of a perfect example of it's all about this bombastic, over-the-top artwork, really large panels and splash pages, tight costumes and sometimes exaggerated female form. And just that, again, that bombast that was there in the 90s where the art kind of ruled all. It very much like eye candy, right? Like going to see a big budget popcorn flick, you know, summer blockbuster kind of thing, where it's all about, you know, this assault on your senses. This was Cyberforce was that, you know, all these cool ideas. You know, we're talking about the early 90s where computers and the internet and that sort of thing was just becoming kind of part of the zeitgeist of pop culture, and people were starting to get internet, and people, you know, it was a huge uptick in the amount of households that had computers and technology and that sort of thing. So when you talk about Cyberforce, you know, this idea of taking these mutants that were captured by cyber data, if you're not familiar with the initial concept, there are these superpowered beings in the Cyberforce universe. They're captured by a company called CyberData or CyberData International, and they are modified with these implants of technology, these cybernetic implants, in order to try to make them what they called SHOCs, which stood for Special Hazardous Operations Cyborgs. So CyberData's sort of own superpowered team, you know, their own strike force to go out and perform the wishes of this evil corporation that CyberData was. So again, but, you know, at the time, early 90s technology and that sort of thing, it was the perfect time to delve into this idea of enhancing people, right? And again, they already had superpowers, and so it made them, you know, even a step above. Certainly there are characters that didn't have powers, and you could, you know, implant them with cybernetic enhancements as well, and you know, they would be more than they were before, but it wasn't to the level, you know, that the Cyberforce was. So and I think it worked. It's fun. It works for the time period. So there have been various iterations of Cyberforce since then, right? Like I said, we had that initial four issue run, and then the longest one was the one that the series that ran after that from 94 to 97, the second volume, about 35 issues. And then it kind of went away for a while, and they brought it back as part of Ron Mars when he was heavily involved with the Top Cow universe, and he was doing the artifacts and stuff like that. So that was around the mid 2000s, and it was sort of just a continuation of the series that ended in 97, but obviously updated because 6 years, 7 years had gone by or what have you. And so that one didn't really catch on either. Maybe it was always planned as six issues. But again, it sort of came and went. Just here's an update. Here's where these characters are. But it didn't really catch on. So then again, it was relaunched in 2012. And this was part of the Top Cow Rebirth initiative. And there was a Kickstarter campaign, and there were issues that were released for free. And it did pretty well. It did pretty well. It was updated because it was early 2010s. I think it was 2011, 2012. So it did pretty well, but again, didn't last that long. And it seems like a kind of a running thing with Cyberforce that it starts off with a bang, and then it kind of peters out. I'm struggling to put my finger on why. And then we had a fifth volume that launched in 2015 that was digital only, that was written by Matt Hawkins. And I think that one sort of has roots in what we eventually get here, the series that was launched in 2018, also written by Matt Hawkins, but also with Brian Hill. And the thing that I love about this one, with bringing Brian Hill on board in this particular series, is, and Brian's talked about this, it's the idea of exploring the idea of transhumanism. So if you're not familiar with the concept of transhumanism, it's sort of this philosophy that we as humans can sort of surpass the limitations of our biological bodies and become something more by taking advantage of technology. So we all know that we age, and we're subject to disease, and we're subject just to the ravages of time as our bodies get older. You know, for whatever reason, our genetic makeup is sort of pre-programmed to only last a finite amount of time, as opposed to other living organisms on this planet whose genetic code allows them to keep going for much, much longer. Sharks, for example, You can look at giant tortoises that live, you know, hundreds of years. If you want to look to the plant world, there's trees and plant life that lives thousands of years. So it's not unheard of. And there's no reason, theoretically, that we couldn't live longer, you know, if our cells just continued to replicate themselves and replicate themselves without flaw. And that would allow us to just, you know, keep regenerating and go on indefinitely in theory. So this idea of transhumanism is introducing concepts, ideas, technology, mostly in the form of actually integrating technology into our bodies to sort of overcome those limitations. And we're not just talking about age, but being able to be stronger, or, you know, run faster, or see farther, or think faster, be able to do, you know, more calculations in your brain, more complex calculations, be able to recall memories from your past with perfect clarity and perfect detail. So this idea, it's not new. I think it originated in the 50s or 60s, maybe even a little earlier than that. Some of the first, you know, futurologists, the people that were looking to the future and thinking, you know, these concepts that seem like science fiction to us, some of them have come to pass and some of them still are out of reach. But it's an interesting concept to think about, because as Brian Hills decided to explore this, the aspect or kind of the approach he's taking is, okay, at what point do you stop being human? How far can you go? How much of yourself can you replace and still be human? You know, if you lose a limb and you replace it, you're technically a cyborg at that point, but you're still human. What if it's two limbs? What if it's four? What if it's everything but your head? What if it's your entire body and your consciousness is just implanted in it? Like, where do you draw the line? What does it mean to be human? You know, how far can you go? Because technically, when you think about it, if you start talking about cyborgs, we've had cyborgs walking around for a long time. You know, if you want to just look at the technical definition of cyborg, a cybernetic organism, a living, breathing organism that has machine technology integrated in them. So things like pacemakers or internal defibrillators, or people that have cochlear implants because they have hearing impairments. All those are machines. They're technology. It's metal. You know, it's things we have created that are then implanted into biological organisms to make their life better in some way, either to regulate their heartbeat or to shock their heart back into normal rhythm if it gets out of rhythm, or to help them hear. There's talk of possibly having the cochlear implant version of sight, right? Something that you can implant in your eye, or have one of your eyes replaced so that you can see if you've got some degenerative eye disease, or you were born without eyes, or something like that. You know, assuming that the nerves are intact, and you would attach these cybernetic eyes to your vision, and then, you know, you technically can see, but you're a cyborg. Right. And then there's all kinds of other questions that come along with that. What if it gives you an advantage in sports? You know, like if you're a baseball player and you have a cybernetic eye and it allows you to see the ball better, is that fair? Like, where do you draw the line? And, you know, what's allowed and what's not allowed? I mean, if somebody's born and, you know, with a congenitive birth defect, and they go blind by the age of three, are you going to deny them, you know, the ability to do certain things because it gives them an unfair advantage? And let's take it a step further in terms of, who controls the implant, who owns the implant. You know, these implants are going to cost millions and millions of dollars, certainly at first, and you can't afford it, but the company wants to test it. And so they give it to you basically for free, but they still legally own it. And then what happens? Can they take it away from you? Where's the ethical lines there? So there's a lot of ideas that can really be explored. And some of them are more overt in these first four issues of Cyberforce, and some of them are a little more subtle. So let's go ahead and dive into issue one. As I mentioned, it's written by Matt Hawkins and Brian Hill. It has art and colors by Attilio Rojo. Letters are by Troy Petrie. So it starts off, we're in Cupertino, California. we see this armored character with a red visor, black armor, and there's a voiceover that is from the future. And we know this is happening in the past because it says Cupertino, California, 7 days ago. The voiceover is happening in present time, and it's talking about Mr. Stryker, who, you know, we're going to know as Morgan Stryker, who was Stryker in the first Cyber Force, is Stryker here. He was present at this event that was about to happen, and they're asking him, hey, what do you remember from what happened in Cupertino? In the timeline that we're actually seeing in the flashback in Cupertino 7 days ago, we see this armored figure, black armor, red visor, and this individual says, now I'm become life, the savior of worlds. So that's a play on a quote from Vishnu, Hindu, I think it's Hindi goddess, who is supposedly the goddess of death. And it's most famously known as a quote from Robert Oppenheimer, who worked on the Manhattan Project, creating the atomic bomb. And he quoted Vishnu, and he said, now I'm become death, the destroyer of worlds, because he had helped create the atomic bomb and he felt guilty about it. So now we have this individual who is apparently the savior of worlds. Now I'm become life, the savior of worlds. Whatever they're about to do, they feel is in the best interest of life, of the world. And it goes into another aspect that I'll talk about at the end, which is the question of, just because you can do something, should you? You know, the ethics of that. So in Cupertino, California, we're actually at the campus of some technology company, and Stryker apparently is security there. We see him wounded in the battle as this person in armor attacks this this facility. We see one of Stryker's eyes is destroyed, part of his face is damaged, and he has an arm that's holding a pistol. He's trying to fire at this individual that's completely severed just below the shoulder, and he sees this person walk by him, and he's relaying this as they're asking him, what do you remember? And he says, I remember, you know, my life being shattered. I remember being wounded. I remember I saw something I thought was impossible. And this thing looked at me like it knew me, and she let me live. So apparently it's a female. And he says, yeah, she let me live. And the person that's questioning Stryker says, yes, it seems that way, but only you. And so it's great artwork from Attilio Rojo, watching this armored female figure go in and just destroy this campus and kill everybody there. So how does that sort of jive with what she said about, now I'm become life, the savior of worlds? The savior of worlds means you're going to destroy everybody that works at this campus of this technology company. I mean, when we get a view right before the attack, we see people working on computers and like working on the actual hardware of the computers, motherboards and whatnot. We see people flying drones. You know, it seems like the campus of a place like Google or, you know, Apple or something like that. And then everybody is killed. So what were they doing there that this armored female figure thinks that she needs to go in and destroy them? So then we get a picture of, or a scene of Morgan Stryker in a hospital bed, and you can see the damage to his face and his eye, and he's missing that arm, as I said. And they say he's seizing, stabilize him, and they put him under again. Meanwhile, out in the world, and this must be soon after the attack, we get scenes of various cities, New York City, Beijing, London, Paris, Shibuya, Japan. And this person has managed to take over all the airwaves, all screens, all communication devices. And she's saying that she's here to save you, basically, you know, just I'm life, I've become life, the savior of worlds. And she's telling everybody, I'm speaking to you all, and I'm not allowing you to be the architects of your own extinction. And everybody hears it in their own language, wherever they happen to be around the world. She says, I'm not cruel. I'm not your enemy. I'm actually your savior. She says, I'm the firewall against your march toward destruction. So she's standing between us and oblivion, apparently. Your addiction to technology, she says. She says, you've made gods of machines, and these gods will not be merciful. These gods will be cruel. I've seen it for myself. Their judgment's going to be the downfall of you. So apparently she knows something about the future, or she comes from the future. She's seen what happens when technology goes too far, whether it's transhumanism or just allowing machines to become sentient or something along those lines. Humanity's dependence on technology leads to humanity's downfall. She's come back in time to stop it from happening. It explains why she's willing to, for lack of a better term, break some eggs to make the omelet, right? Sorry, I have to kill all these people at this technology company, at this technological campus, but it's important to save the human race. So we actually see another campus. It's a Microtech Center, very much an analog for Microsoft based on the design we see. In Richmond, Virginia, we see that one blow up as well. And then we're introduced to Karen Stryker, who's Morgan Stryker's daughter. She's 18 years old, and she's being asked by somebody, Karen, you know, your dad's in a coma, but you're 18. That gives you the authority to save our daughter, but you need to make your decision immediately. Do you understand what we're asking? And Karen's crying and she's upset. Apparently her mother's gone. She only has her father. She's not sure what to do. And she looks at this person, this doctor who's given her this offer and says, you can save him, right? And the doctor responds, we can do more than that. When we're finished, your father's going to be the pinnacle of human achievement. So they're talking about doing more than just saving him. But this just doesn't, like, right away, it doesn't sit right with me. You know, it feels like needs time to make this decision. And from what we've seen of Morgan Stryker, I mean, he's lost his arm, yeah, and an eye and part of his face is injured. But it doesn't seem that that would kill him. You know, it seems like he should be able to survive that. But I think these people want to take advantage, you know, take advantage of the naivete of this 18-year-old girl, take advantage of her, you know, her need, her feelings of being all alone in the world, take advantage of her feelings of affection and love for her father to agree to go ahead and do whatever these changes are. You know, she doesn't want to be alone. And so she says, okay, all you have to do is sign this. And Karen, as she's about to sign, says, I feel like my whole world is falling apart. And the doctor tries to comfort her and says, you know, there's a lot of smart people out there that are trying to keep the world together. And you'll go into surgery prep today. And there's some fiscal compensation associated. And I'll get the paperwork started. And we're like, wait, what? Why is Karen going into surgery prep? I thought this was to save her father. She is in a wheelchair, right? I guess I should mention that. So apparently she can't walk. So what exactly is it that she's agreed to? But when the doctor does mention the monetary aspect, Karen does say, I don't want money, but I do want something, but we're not told what it is. So on the following page, we see, and it's very well done by Atilio Rojo, both in terms of how it's laid out, the composition of the panels, as well as the coloring. It's kind of greenish gray and very nefarious, people in shadow. We see the doctor leave the room and walk up to somebody and say, it's done. You have what you wanted. It's just taken a terrorist act to give it to you. And the other woman in shadow turns away saying, within crisis lies opportunity. So clearly they're the puppet masters. They're manipulating. They've taken advantage of the situation. And it's sufficiently creepy. We know it's definitely not in the up and up based on, again, the kind of the body language and the colors that were given by Rojo. So we then proceed to 4 weeks later. We see somebody punching a wall. It's Morgan Stryker. He's still in his hospital room and he's freaking out. They're watching him on camera. He's destroying things, throwing stuff around. And that same doctor is asking the nurse, so he's awake. How's he managing? Well, doctor, I think you should come see for yourself. Like, yeah, Helen, what's he saying though? And we finally get a look at Stryker. He's raising his arm up to the sky, screaming, what did you do to me? And we see that arm and shoulder have been replaced by metal. It's some sort of metallic arm and part of his rib cage and his eye as well and part of his face. And he's just losing it. So they gas him to try to you know, knock him out and get him under control. And the doctors come down to the observation room. She's looking at him and saying, yeah, he's angry. He woke up a different man, but it's natural. It's to be expected. You know, it's traumatic to wake up and part of your body's been replaced by machinery. So we fast forward another week and Stryker is talking to that same doctor saying, I want to see my daughter. And she says, you know, we're working towards that. You know, we did save your life, though. We're not the enemy. And we're the only reason that you survived and that you'll be able to see Karen again. We need you to understand that. Again, I just don't think that's true. I think he would have survived anyway, based on the amount of damage, you know, based on the amount of his body that was injured. Didn't seem like it was this, you know, huge amount. We've certainly seen people lose limbs before and survive or lose an eye. But again, it just feels like this company is manipulating. You know, they want what they want, and they're going to tell whatever lies they need to tell to get that. So the doctor asked me, you'd be willing to listen to us? I love the response. Morgan's like, well, you didn't change my ears, so I guess I can listen. She says, okay, well, it's remarkable. You're alive and you're better than you ever were before. And Morgan's like, okay, can you remove it? Can you take it out of me? And she says, nah, because upgrades have been bonded to your anatomy. They're part of you now, part of your homeostatic processes. So removing one now would be like removing your organs. And again, immediately I call bullshit. I'm like, what are you talking about? It's just an arm and an eye. If you have planted other things, which is entirely possible, that weren't necessary, then maybe that's the case. She's like, it's like removing one of your organs. Well, people get organs removed if necessary to do a transplant, or, you know, if they're removed because they're diseased or something. So don't tell me you can't do it at all. And then she goes on to saying, yeah, your daughter did authorize the procedure. And Morgan, he doesn't like that. And I don't blame him. He's like, yeah, she's not old enough to understand, you know, what you people meant. I want to see her. And she's like, well, you know, that's, maybe that can be arranged, but not yet. And Morgan's like, well, what am I supposed to do? Like, what, why did you do this? And she said, well, try aiming a weapon. You won't ever miss. You can punch a wall. Your arm won't break. And he's like, well, if I'm so strong, where can I break these bonds? And here's where we start to get to the things that really worry me. She says, well, you've been given an inhibitor for your protection and ours. And Stryker, he immediately knows what's up. He's like, so I'm a product, right? A thing you control. You just gave me this arm and this eye. But yeah, you're controlling my whole body. I can't even try to break free with my other arm. You know, I'm not even a person anymore. I've lost my freedom. I've lost my individuality. I'm just, a product, something that you made. And she, you know, of course, being the corporate stooge, no, not to me. You're a man with a second chance. And you have all these advantages. And all Morgan cares about is, how can I see my daughter? And the doctor says, well, I am allowed to ingest your inhibitor to allow you to move around normally. You can't use any of your enhancements. You know, you won't be able to punch through walls or anything yet. But I can do that if you agree to continue the therapy. And again, he says, okay, so when can I see her then? Well, it demonstrates some progress, both psychologically and physically, and then we'll see. Let me help you. And Morgan kind of gives in, saying, okay, well, tell me what you need to do. I mean, he just wants to see his daughter and know that she's safe. So a week passes. And we see Karen sitting in her chair, staring out some windows. Her dad walks up behind her, finally gets to see her. And she's worried that he's going to be angry with her. And he's like, no, don't worry about it. You saved my life. I'm just ashamed that you had to. Again, that's what they've been told. That's what they believe. I don't buy it necessarily that he would have died, but that's what they've been told. And so Karen looks at him and, you know, sees the cybernetic eye and arm and says, does it hurt? And he says, no, it feels like I'm in somebody else's body. And I guess I am. I'm in their body. I'm in the body that they made for me. You know, they own it. And she says, well, how much did they tell you? And he said, well, just a bunch of techno babble. I didn't really understand it. I guess I'm going to be better at killing things now. And I'm just waiting for them to tell me who they want to kill. I guess they want me to find the person responsible for the attack. So that's what I know. And Karen says, yeah, everybody's afraid of this person. We don't even know who it is. Are you going to do it? Are you going to help them stop this? And Morgan says, well, I think so. You know, a lot of people died and there were a lot of people that deserved a second chance. I'm the one that got it for whatever reason, the only one that got it. So I guess I should, you know, try to repay them. And Karen says, okay, Dad, well, I have something else I need to tell you. I guess I should just show you. And she gets up from her wheelchair. And the blanket that she has covering her legs falls away. And she says, I'm so sorry, Dad, but I wanted this. And we see that her legs, her whole lower body has been replaced by cybernetic legs. And the look on Morgan's face, he's kind of surprised. He says, wow, they gave it to you. And Karen says, yeah, I'm terrified that you won't forgive me that I did this. And Stryker says, Karen, I'm just worried they're gonna want to make you a part of this. Now they own us both. So he knows right from the start that this isn't some sort of, well, let me wait and see. Maybe they do have our best interests at heart. No, it's, they took advantage of the situation. I guarantee you, if Morgan Stryker doesn't get injured, he does not let his daughter get her legs replaced, whether she's, you know, 18 and adult or not. He would find a way to stop and make it happen. But you can also see it from Karen's point of view. I don't think she's ever been able to walk. And you lose so much in that sort of situation. You know, you're not mobile or as mobile as you would be otherwise. You lose some sense of independence, you know, and you've got to think about the state of mind she's in. She thought she was going to lose her father based on what they told her. So she feels even more vulnerable not being able to walk. So again, this company, CyberData, they took complete advantage of it. It was a perfect situation for them because they know what frame of mind Karen is in. She thinks that her father might die. So not only did she agree to do whatever she can to save her father, if in case that doesn't work, yes, take my legs, give me cybernetic legs, because if I do lose my father, at least I've gained some independence. You know, I can start learning to take care of myself because I won't have my dad to take care of me anymore. And you know, somebody who can't walk and perhaps has never been able to walk, that's probably all she can think about. Hey, give me the chance to walk. Give me the chance to experience that. Flip it around and maybe she could walk previously. And is that could even be worse. I mean, I don't know. I don't have experience with that. But now you know what you're missing even. So yeah, it's a really a tough choice and really a tough thing. But I love the fact that Morgan is completely aware of the moral ambiguity of what this company has done under the guise of saving them, of helping them, of making them better. How have you made me better? I'm faster, stronger, you know, have advantages with this the cybernetic technology that you've grafted onto my body, but I've given, like, you can control me now. You can sit me in a chair, strap me down, and I can't even try to break free. Not even the parts of me that aren't cybernetic because of this quote unquote inhibitor. Like, that's a lot to give up. You know, you've given up your freedom. You are a product. You are just a tool for this company. And if they decide to do something nefarious with you, you know, what are your options to stop it from happening? So it's not a good place to be. And Morgan's aware of it right from the start. So we move on to issue two, same creative team, written by Brian Edward Hill and Matt Hawkins. We have art and colors by Attilio Rojo, and then letters by Troy Petrie. So it starts off, we see Karen running. They're running some tests on her. We're told she can run 120 miles an hour. There's a big concrete wall in front of her. She's running around this track, and they say, oh, are you going to test how fast she can stop? No, we're going to tell her to go right through it. She deserves to have some fun. And she does, indeed, kick right through it. And the scientists at CyberData are pretty happy with themselves. Hey, congratulations, you put a broken young woman back together. And the response is, oh, thank you. I hope our result is better than our last attempt. So clearly this isn't the first time they've tried. They've tried to enhance people before, and apparently it hasn't gone super great. So we do get a glimpse of that on the next page. We move to Russia, exact location unknown. There's a lot of snow. So the implication would be this is, you know, somewhere up in Siberia, remote location. And we see that same black and red armored figure, the female figure, attack some of the guards and take them out and bust inside the installation and eventually get to this this chamber where there's a pod, where there's a female figure in some sort of stasis. And she breaks her out saying, awaken Killjoy to purpose. And this female monstrosity, because I hate to call her that, but she is looks like she's very much cybernetic, except for her head and her torso. Everything else looks to be enhanced, and she has a very villainous look to her because not only is she black everywhere except for her face is white, but then the tip of her nose is black, and around her eyes is black, and her mouth is black, and it basically makes her head look like a skeleton. That's what her face looks like. And as this armored figure awakens her, she says, we need you to accomplish some tasks or I will destroy you. Are we clear? And Killjoy says, very clear, and then attacks her. And she said, you know, I dreamed I was whole again. I was flesh and bone. I wasn't metal. And you woke me up. So she's mad, clearly, that she's been turned into mostly metal and is not happy with this female armored figure that awoken her from that dream. So she says, since I'm awake, I would like to hear you scream. And she tries to attack. She goes for a full direct attack. And we see that the armored figure has the ability to move very quickly, moves out of the way. She's standing next to a wall. She moves out of the way and Killjoy goes slamming into the wall where the armored figure had been standing just a second before. And then we see Killjoy basically get the crap beat out of her, but nobody's attacking her. She's standing there. She's looking around and she's just getting beat on. And we see her almost knocked unconscious before we see her lifted up by her throat. And we see that this armored figure has the ability to become invisible, basically. So as she stands there holding Killjoy off the ground by the throat, she says, well, you know what? You're strong enough. I think that you'll be able to survive a little taming. She's trying to bring her under control, showing Killjoy that, hey, either come along with my way or you're going to be done. You know, my way or the highway, basically. And it's a really cool image from Atelio Rojo. This armored figure literally throws Killjoy through the roof of this facility out in Siberia. She goes flying many yards and lands in the snow. And we see the armored figure use some jets that pop out of her shoulder pads, I guess you'd say. And she flies after and lands at the feet of Killjoy and says, you should have listened to me, Killjoy. Now that Killjoy's kind of gotten her butt kicked, she's ready to listen. She's like, okay, talk. And so the armored figure tells her, I know what was done to you. I know what was taken from you. I know what they made you. And Killjoy's like, you know nothing. And the armored figure says, well, your real name is Amelia Lefebvre. You were a criminal in your first life. And Killjoy's kind of shocked. She's like, well, I can't even remember. And the armored figure says, yes, well, that's because they took it to you. But give me your hand. I can give it back to you. And as she holds out her hand, we do notice on the palm of her hand, on the palm of this armored figure's hand, it looks to be what are a couple of circuit boards on her palm. So being that Killjoy is made of metal herself, seems like there'd be the ability to transfer data. There'd be some sort of interface there. So as Killjoy grabs her hand, she's kind of surprised and she does get a download. She sees herself back when she was human, having just committed some crime. She's driving in a van. She's got a pile of cash next to her in a bag. When all of a sudden another big truck comes out of nowhere and rams her, flips it over, her van explodes and she's trapped in there and literally burned alive. It's pretty brutal, actually. And then on the next page, with this voiceover of the armed figure saying, you remember a wheel of pain, metal arms ripping at you, making you like them, pain upon pain upon pain, like being born through the sun. And they did this to you because you're a criminal. So, you know, why would you not want to help me get back at them, right? They did it to me because they did it to you because you were a woman, and men want to be gods, but they can't be, because when men make life, they only make monsters. The thing that strikes me about this, when we see this image, it's a full page splash of Amelia being turned into Killjoy. And, you know, obviously a lot of her body burned away. And so they're replacing the vast majority of her body, which is what we, you know, see when she wakes up, you know, all her arms, her legs, a lot of her torso, everything but like the core torso part of her and her head. Why in God's name would you keep her awake when you do this? That just seems like barbaric to do that. You know, it just seems so sadistic. And so now that she has her memories back, Killjoy says, yes, my name was Amelia. Who are you? And the armored figure says, well, who do you see? I call myself the accuser. I've come to punish this world for the future. Will you help me? And Killjoy says, yes. You know, what is she going to say? She's full of pain and horrible memories now. So meanwhile, back at CDI, Cyber Data Industries, at the facility, at the track where Karen was running, she's continued to make some laps and take some tests when her dad shows up, and Karen gets a big smile on her face saying, I can run, dad. And Stryker, he wants to be happy for her, but you can tell he's not, because what he tells her is that, yeah, and they're going to make you pay the price for it. This place doesn't help people. they make them into things they want to use, which is what I was saying about, you know, last issue, taking advantage of the situation, manipulating things, pulling strings. They're not helping these people out of the goodness of their heart. And Stryker knows that from the beginning. So Karen's like, well, you're going after the person that almost killed you, so I want to come along. And Stryker's like, oh, no, that's not going to happen. And Karen's like, no, I can help. I have this ability. And you can understand her exuberance and you can understand her excitement. You know, the pendulum has swung so far to the other side. She's been, in her own eyes, helpless and dependent on others to help her, you know, have that freedom and, you know, help her move around with her limited mobility because she couldn't walk. And now all of a sudden she has these legs and she can run 120 miles an hour and she can kick through concrete walls. And she loves her dad. So all you add all that together with the exuberance of youth. Yes, I want to help. And Stryker's like, I don't want your help. You're going to stay here. If they want to see what you can do, what they made you into, fine. You made the choice and we both have to live with it. But I'm going to do whatever I need to do to keep us safe. And I'm doing it alone. So obviously, you know, Karen being 18 years old and, you know, a teenager, she's not real happy that her dad is saying no. So meanwhile, at a CDI prototype facility, we start to see the results of another experiment. There's a human-shaped pod, and it's being pulled off of some storage and brought up close to a bunch of observers. And the voiceover is saying, I'm impressed we're able to do this on such a short schedule. We put a bunch of resources in it. I think you'll all be pleased with the results. We really feel like it was a success. And then the scene flips around and we're looking at all these who I assume are stockholders or investors or high ups in this company of CDI. And the guy that's talking about it says, the question isn't whether this project's going to work. The question is how Morgan Stryker will work with her. And we get to see who's inside this chamber, and it's Aphrodite, who's a character we know from Top Cow, Aphrodite 9, Aphrodite 7. She's, you know, a very, very advanced android, green hair and she kicks butt basically. And she's, we see that it's this early version of her, and it says, to be continued. And we move on to issue number 3. So in issue number 3, it's the same creative team, written by Matt Hawkins and Brian Edward Hill, art and colors by Atilio Rojo, letters by Troy Petrie. And this is basically the history, the origin of this version of Aphrodite. So we start in Scotland 15 years ago. There's a woman, her name is Dr. Morgan. She's overlooking the sea out in Scotland, and she's remembering this interaction she had with these parents. These wealthy parents had come to her. Their son had been gravely injured or died, and they just wanted a chance to talk to him again. And so Dr. Morgan took their money to help fund her research and said, okay, you know, I'm willing to do that. We're going to challenge God. We're going to stand in the face of nature against death itself. And after a time, she thinks that she's succeeded. So she invites them to her house. She takes them down into her basement laboratory. And there we see, I do think this guy's dead. He's hooked up to all these cables in some sort of immersion tank. Dr. Morgan is telling these parents that she spent her lifetime solving the riddle of consciousness, and it's already done. They're going to be able to talk to their son again. And they're kind of horrified by what they see. And Dr. Morgan says, ignore that body that you see in that tank. Your son is here now. And she comes over to this box that's on this server rack, you know, filled with different computers and networking equipment. And she touches it and says, activate consciousness protocol. And then she tells the parents, speak to him. He can hear you. And the parents are shocked, like look on their face. This wasn't what they wanted, right? They were asking her to somehow bring their son back to life. But instead they hear a voice coming from this box saying, I can't see, I can't see. He's got no ability to see. It's his consciousness that has just been transferred into this, you know, giant flash drive, for lack of a better term. And the parents are horrified, saying, son, is that you, Eric? Eric, we're here. And he's like, dad, mom, I can't see you. Where are you? Help me. And they're horrified by what they've allowed to be done. And the son starts screaming. And Dr. Morgan's like, okay, their son screams, but I feel no guilt, because just the fact that he's screaming means that he's feeling something, means that he's still alive. I've done it. And the parents are horrified, saying, turn it off now. And even though Morgan feels like it's a success, she's done what they asked her to do. They curse her and they run out, and she's telling herself, I didn't fail them. I did what they asked me to do. And meanwhile, their son keeps talking, where am I? Help me, help me. And Morgan says, well, you're alive. But then she said, end consciousness protocol and delete all data. And we hear the son scream one more time. So pretty brutal here from Morgan. You know, she took their money. She did what they asked, technically. But they were horrified by it. Then she just deletes the data. So the guy really is dead. I mean, I don't know what else she was going to do with him. And is maybe that's better than having the consciousness aware that it's been, trapped in this this data storage device. So later, Morgan's looking out over that same cliff, looking out over the water, when somebody from Cyber Data shows up and says, Dr. Morgan, I represent a group known as Cyber Data, funny name, I know, but I assure you our interest is genuine. They've heard about what she was able to do, and they're there to offer her a world without limits, as much funding as she needs, protection from international law, because again, what she did, not exactly moral or ethical. Like, there's a lot of questions there about saving somebody's consciousness or transferring it. And this guy says, we believe in you and we believe in your mind. Let us challenge God together. So then she agrees to it. We fast forward 1 year. She's having trouble. She just can't manage to give this thing consciousness, because what she's trying to do is not necessarily transfer somebody's consciousness, but try to create life itself. She says, Cyber Data, they don't want a machine. They don't just want consciousness stored in a machine. They want life that is born in a machine. They want the ones and zeros to spontaneously become life. So we're talking beyond artificial intelligence here. You know, we're talking about not something that has pre-programmed responses, but the spark of life itself, happening inside machinery, happening in code, in ones and zeros. And she says, yeah, I've created the system. It can solve problems. It follows commands, but it doesn't think. It's not alive. It's not self-aware. And she says, the soul is the riddle, right? And if our minds are mechanistic triumphs, if there's just a combination of cells and energy that make consciousness, then it's a riddle that I can solve. And that's not too far of a leap. And I love what Brian Hill and Matt Hawkins are saying here. Technically, when you think about it, we're just biological. We're machines as well, but we just happen to be made out of biological tissue instead of, metallic tissue or metallic materials or something else. But when you think about it, we start breaking it all down to the smallest components. We're made of the same stuff, right? Like everything is made of atoms. So if it's all just atoms and molecules, then why can't you just get the configuration right in, whether it be in a machine or it be in a human, and then be able to create life? And, this is something that has been told in stories and fiction, and mankind has thought about, like, what is it? What is life? When does it start? What is that esoteric spark? What does it mean to be alive, to be individual, to be thinking, to be sentient, to be self-aware? And why haven't we been able to do it ourselves? And that's the challenge that Dr. Morgan has set before her. That's what Cyber Data wants her to do. And so Morgan says, yeah, it's just a contest between me and God. And God continues to hide the secret, but I'll find it and God will lose. So she's thinking about what she needs to do, right? She's like telling this thing that she's created, you will live. It'll be like a fetus waiting to be born, but you're going to be born inside the machine. You just have to be patient. I'm your mother. I'm your creator. And you will wake from this computerized womb that I've created for you, and you will think and you will feel and you will exist, and I will solve God's riddle. But apparently it's not working out, because we fast forward another year, and that same guy that recruited her is kind of reading her the riot. It's only been 2 years, dude. But corporate stooges aren't exactly known for their pay. So he's telling her, you haven't made any progress. And she's like, no, I've made great progress, but you're asking for independent consciousness born inside a machine. And every day we're getting closer. And this guy's like, yeah, but your project, it can't speak. It can't respond. It's not alive. All you've done is made this very expensive collection of data. And she's like, look, it took me a decade to figure out a way to preserve human consciousness inside a machine. And you want me to create pure artificial life in less time than that? That's completely unrealistic. This guy's like, well, we want the results you promised us, or we want you to admit it's not possible. She's like, I'm not going to admit that. I just need more time and more money, and I need you to leave me alone to work on this. And he gets mad and he says, look, there's concern that you've misrepresented your ability, that you're not able to actually do what you say you can do. And you should be worried that we're all going to agree that that is true. And if we do, then you're going to pay. Everything you've done is going to be the price you pay for the debt that you've incurred, including your life. Your life itself may be required as payment. So this guy's a complete scumbag with completely unrealistic expectations. It took her 10 years to figure out how to transfer the data. And she's supposed to just figure out, working by herself, how to create artificial life in less than 2 years. I mean, come on, man. It's completely unrealistic. So we get a little more insight into Dr. Morgan. We find out that she has a lover, a lesbian lover, and her name is Emily, and she's a technician, and she works at CyberData as well. And Morgan is worried that CyberData manipulated it for Emily to be there for her to fall in love with, because then it's just one more pressure point that they can push on to try to get her to accomplish what they want. But she can't help it. She loves Emily. She needs to love something. And she confides in Emily, and Emily's horrified. She's like, they can't kill you. And Morgan's like, I'm fairly sure these people can do whatever they want. But what they don't understand is I don't fear death. I hate it. And we learn that apparently it's cancer is what I think it is. But we learn that her father, in Dr. Morgan's terms, rotted away in front of her. And when that happened that day, Dr. Morgan knew she was going to dedicate her life to correcting the flaws of nature. And she lets the memory of her father, quote unquote, rotting away in front of her, remind her of that purpose. So she's not scared to die. She's not scared of death. She hates death. That's why she does what she does. And she's trying to eliminate it, find a way to prolong life, that sort of thing. So even though she knows she does, she maybe shouldn't love Emily, she can't help it. But as more and more time goes on, she's running experiments with this Aphrodite android that she's created, but she's having a tough time. When she asks questions, it responds, but it's a human voice, but it's all just based on algorithms. There's no thought there. They're automated responses. And to that point, when she asks Aphrodite, do you dream? Aphrodite says, I don't understand the question. What is a dream? Okay, well, we don't even really know. It's just something that living minds do. It would be proof that you were alive if you could dream. Why don't you tell me how you feel, Aphrodite? And Aphrodite says, oh, I'm functioning normally. Temperature in the room, 74 degrees. The time is blah, blah, blah. You know, and again, it's not, these aren't emotions. She's just giving her the, you know, literally reading her the weather, you know, telling her how things are. They're not actual signs of life. And Morgan gets frustrated and tells Aphrodite to shut down. And then we flash forward again, more time has passed, and she still hasn't been able to succeed. And she talks about how they took Emily away to punish her. Again, probably the whole reason they had her had them fall in love in the first place, you know, the whole reason they set it up for them to meet each other. And it's torture for Dr. Morgan. She's forced to watch them take Emily outside as she's watching through the window, put a gun to the back of her head and blow her brains out. I mean, it's brutal. And they accuse Morgan of holding back. They say, you're not dedicating everything to your task. You're spending too much time with Emily. You know, you're not focused on what you need to do. Well, you guys are the ones that set it up, pulled the strings. But they're not going to kill Morgan. She's too valuable. So they kill Emily instead. And then they put Morgan on suicide watch. We see her in her lab curled up in a little ball. Trying to figure out what she's going to do, trying to get over the loss and the trauma that she suffered. And Morgan is thinking how stupid it is for them to have her on suicide watch, because she has no intention of killing herself, because if she dies, she won't be able to hate CDI anymore. And she has sworn to keep on hating them. And she has to have a way to hate them forever. She's never going to forgive them for what they've done to Emily. So in this hatred, she realizes she solved the riddle of life. She knows how she's going to bring Aphrodite to life. So she goes to her boss and says, okay, give me what I asked, provide me what I'm asking for, and you'll have what you need. And the guy's like, if this is just a guess, a shot in the dark, it's an expensive one, doctor. And Morgan says, look, you're not paying for an attempt. You're paying for the result. So give me what I need, and then you'll have your artificial life. So the following spring, we see Aphrodite is there, ready to be implanted in some way. We see this chair that Morgan herself looks like she's about to sit down in. And I do notice that Morgan is very skinny in this picture. She's lost a lot of weight. Clearly, she's been dedicating herself to doing nothing but finding the cure, the answer for life. And she tells us she's cyber data has given her what she needs without question. And they don't even really ask her what she's doing because they know they wouldn't understand it anyway. And she knows that it's not possible what they're asking for. Artificial life from nothing is not possible. It's just not possible to turn a collection of ones and zeros into something alive. But what she can do is she can put life into the ones and zeros. It's not possible to get life from the ones and zeros, but it's possible to infuse the ones and zeros, possible to infuse the programming with life. So we see her sit in this chair and she says, begin synthesis. And it becomes clear that she's going to give her life to the project. And she even says, I only have one life to give. So she couldn't find a way to create life spontaneously, but apparently she has found a way to sacrifice her own life to infuse the programming of Aphrodite with her own life. What of Morgan survives? We just don't know. Will she have the memories? Will she have the hatred for cyber data? Will she have the feelings of love and loss for Emily? All that is still unclear. But on the next page, we do see that facility where she worked at burning. EMS crews and guards and whatnot running into the building. And there's a voiceover saying, consider her a weapon, the most powerful weapon in the world, and she's here to support you. And it took great pains to manufacture her Striker. Great pains. And then we see another panel where Aphrodite is holding the head of the guy that initially recruited Morgan, the one that ordered the death of Emily. So whether or not Aphrodite had the memories or not, she still had the motivation, apparently, to go and kill this guy and kill a lot of the guards that were there in that facility. But that's not what they tell Striker. What they tell Striker is, unfortunately, the woman who created her died in a facility accident. But we believe the price of her creation was worth it. And as the guards approach her, you know, she's holding the head of this guy who was such a scumbag to her. And Aphrodite looks up at the guards and says, I'm Aphrodite. So what they tell Striker here in current time is she'll be in the field with you, Striker. She, like you, is the future of civilization. And the scene then shifts to now. And we see Aphrodite. She's sitting inside this plexiglass booth, just waiting to be activated, apparently. And Striker says, well, is it alive or is it a machine? And they tell Striker, well, it's both, sort of. And it'll help you find your target. And Striker's like, well, does it want to help me find my target? And this is... a very interesting response that the technician gives Striker. Says, well, that's the true beauty of her design, Striker. She'll want whatever we choose her to want, whatever we tell her to want. God makes life with free will. We don't. And Striker's like, you shouldn't be so proud of that. And I love the fact that Hawkins and Hill have created such a self-aware character in Morgan Striker, right? These scientists have, you know, beyond their Machiavellian motivations, beyond their ability to for whatever reason, whether it's greed or power or whatever, to want to create these cybernetic organisms and control them. Striker doesn't buy for 1 minute any kind of altruistic or we're looking out for the future of mankind. No, they're only looking out for themselves. We're going to find out there's somebody, you know, eventually it all leads to one person. These kind of organizations, you know, you have, all these different, you know, C-level executives, CEO, COO, CFO, CIO, all that kind of stuff. And then you have the, you know, the board of directors and all that. Eventually all leads to one person. There's one person pulling the strings here And, you know, they can say whatever they want, whatever PR spin or, you know, corporate speak they want. But at the end of the day, they're out for themselves, and Stryker understands that fundamentally. And so I like that that is such a part of his character. Then the scene shifts to Killjoy and the female character in the black and red armor, and the armored figure's telling her, Killjoy, I'm not interested in your psychopathy. I come from a future where everything is lost. We can't allow that future to happen. I won't allow it to happen. And Killjoy says, you think you're from the future, man? You're crazier than I am. And she says, I'm not a man. I'm something that shouldn't even exist, from a time that should not exist. And I freed you because I can use you. I need you to commit the violence that I need you to commit, so the world will understand why we need to fight this war. They're going to send their best to destroy us, and one of them will even be me. And Killjoy's like, wait, they're going to send you to destroy us? Well, who are you? And we see the figure take off her helmet, and it's Aphrodite. And she says, I was born out of the hubris of humanity. They named me Aphrodite in honor of their vanity, and we have to find a way to stop them. So this apparently is some future version of Aphrodite sent back in time to destroy the current version of Aphrodite, as well as all these technological companies, to prevent some, I don't know, rise in artificial intelligence or rise in some particular types of machines. And it's so interesting. It's that dichotomy of this version of Aphrodite, this future version of Aphrodite saying, I am become life, the savior of worlds, while she's dispensing death. So Killjoy just wants her revenge. So I guess it all lines up for her in that way. Moving on to the final and fourth and final issue of the first volume, again, written by Matt Hawkins and Brian Edward Hill, with art by Attilio Rojo. He handles the colors as well, and letters by Troy Petrie. And it starts off with Stryker discussing with Aphrodite whether he can trust her. And Aphrodite says, well, I was created to assist you in all ways. And Stryker says, yeah, but trust isn't created. Trust is earned. And Aphrodite says, I understand that. Like, I'm, you know, programmed to protect you and neutralize our common threat. And Stryker says, yeah, I get that. But my daughter is a part of that as well. And no one cares what happens to her but me. And none of them care what happens to any of us as long as they get what they want. And then we see Karen in a locker room, and she's got her costume on for the first time, I guess you'd call it. And Stryker saying, well, this is who you are now, huh? And Karen says, yeah, I even got to pick my mission name. And she says, and Stryker says, well, what did you choose? Well, I chose Velocity. They suggested Kid Velocity, but that makes me sound like a little girl. And Stryker, like, you know, every parent ever, that's because you are a little girl. You're my little girl. And God, you don't have to do this, Karen. We can run away. I'll go with you. Make them find us. And then when they find us, make them regret that they found us, and we can run again. And Karen says, I will run, Dad, but I'm not running away. You've protected me my entire life, and now I have the power to protect you. Somebody almost killed you, and we're going to find him. So it goes back to what I was talking about before, how the pendulum has swung so far for Karen. You know, she has felt so dependent on her father, you know, more so than a fully able-bodied person might. And now that she's got abilities even beyond a normal person, she wants to use that power to help protect her dad. She wants to be close to dad. It's that, you know, to use a word that Aphrodite used, the hubris, right? The hubris of youth in this case. So then we see Killjoy and Aphrodite overlooking the facility, about to attack. And Aphrodite's talking about how humanity loses the future to the war of their own arrogance, because again, in their arrogance, they created these machines, never stopping to think if they should, only if they could, which I'll talk about at the end here. But it was technology that turned against them, and now nothing remains. And she's come back to the past to make sure that future never happens. And Killjoy says, I just want to punish the people that made me. The future is your problem. I don't care. And Aphrodite says, future Aphrodite says, well, we can both have what we want. I freed you to help me turn them into ash. And the progress towards that starts now. And we see that behind her, she has this giant two-legged armored war tank machine-like thing. I don't even know what to call it. Clearly from the future, but it's got a bunch of cannons and missiles. just some sort of battle bot. And meanwhile, inside the base, Morgan's telling Karen and Aphrodite, okay, we need to do some assessments on our ability to work as a team and plan our attack and while we try to track our target. And Aphrodite's like, I don't really think there's time for that. Morgan's like, look, let me finish what I'm saying, and then you can say whatever you're programmed to say. And Aphrodite, you know, looks disappointed in that kind of response. And Stryker, you know, he wants to do this by the numbers, by the book, very much a military guy. He says, look, we need to test our strategy while we try to track down the target. So whoever attacked me, they have a personal energy signature, and we, you know, probably comes from the armor they were wearing. So let's coordinate with CDI and figure out a way to track that. And as they're discussing this, Karen's like, Dad, do you hear that? And there's a whistling in the air. And what it is it's the missiles from that attack bot that Aphrodite has that she's fired on the facility. So wasting no time, Karen grabs Aphrodite and her dad each by an arm and uses her super speed to run out of the conference room they're in right before it explodes when a missile lands on it. And Aphrodite has managed to blow a hole in the side of the building and tells Killjoy, hey, I've made you a door, use it. So Killjoy jumps in and confronts Karen and Aphrodite and Morgan Stryker. And she says, my name is Killjoy. Tell me, heroes, how would you like to die? And she prepares to attack. So Aphrodite tells Stryker, hey, you need weapons. Go get them. I'll give you time. And then she goes one-on-one with Killjoy. So Karen grabs her dad and starts running through the facility, trying to get him to where the weapons are. When they see some people that are in danger, they're trying to evacuate one of the other buildings. And Karen says, hey, Dad, those people need our help. And Stryker pauses for a moment and says, Karen, are you sure you're ready for this? I said, hey, if you're next to me, Dad, I'm always ready. So he says, yeah, I do need to find a weapon. And meanwhile, Killjoy and Aphrodite are fighting, and Aphrodite is able to get the upper hand and kind of shove her away. Meanwhile, future Aphrodite, still in the battle bot, has broken into the nerve center of this CDI facility where they have all their network equipment and where their servers are, all their information is stored. They connect to the outside world, and she uses a hack and interfaces with all this network equipment and commences what she calls the EMP protocol. It says, turn out the lights. And through the connection that Cyber Data has with all the rest of the world, including satellites in space, she manages to destroy all the communication satellites in space that allow everybody to talk to everybody else around the world. And she takes the entire power grid of the world offline. She basically shuts down the electricity. She shuts down the internet. She shuts down everything. Global blackout has been initiated. And then she says to herself, now the world is free. So meanwhile, we see Karen then attack her battle bot and disable one of the legs. So future Aphrodite has to then fight one-on-one. She jumps out and attacks Karen and pulls out a couple pistols and says to Karen, I'm sorry, but you shouldn't exist. And she's just as she's about to kill Karen, Morgan shows up. He's managed to find a weapon and he blasts future Aphrodite away from his daughter. But future Aphrodite says, you're too late, Morgan. It's already done. And she removes her helmet. And Morgan's like, you look just like, says Aphrodite. Yeah, I am Aphrodite. I'm Aphrodite from a time and a place that can never be. And Morgan's like, you know what? Part of me wants to know what the hell you're talking about. And the other part of me doesn't give a damn. So future Aphrodite says, listen, Morgan, forget about me. You hate the people that have done this to you and your daughter. You know they're up to no good. Just continue hating them. And she opens up a little pad on her gauntlet. And as she starts to fade away, she says, protect this world from itself. And there's this big explosion of power. We're not sure, did she just self-destruct herself? What exactly happened? And even Karen and Stryker are trying to figure it out. And they say, well, we're not sure what happened, but we need to go find Aphrodite, the other one, our Aphrodite. And as they say that, Killjoy comes flying out of a hole in the building and lands at their feet. And their Aphrodite, present day Aphrodite, comes walking out saying, she's unconscious, but she's alive and functional. What happened to her other target? And Stryker says, the better question is, what happened to our world? Can you tell? And Aphrodite kind of, you know, reaches out with her senses and says, I don't know. Everything's a void. There's no network to connect to. There's no internet. There's apparently no power. Nothing's is talking back to me. I think our enemy turned off the whole world. So then we turn the page and we see the future, and future Aphrodite didn't blow herself up. She didn't self-destruct. What she did was she transported herself to the future to see the results of what she's just done, right? She thinks that she's, by causing this worldwide blackout, she's turned off technology and prevented the future that she feared from coming to pass. But once she kind of recovers from herself, even though during the transport, she lost part of an arm, you know, from the forearm down, her arm's missing. When she turns around, she says, no, I failed. And the whole outside wall of her laboratory or whatever it is, or the facility where she teleported back to, is gone. And outside, she sees a war still waging between machines and men. We see, you know, a lot of ships in the sky that are flying, and we see metallic looking spiders and insects, and they're firing at armored men. And there's fires all around and smoke. And Aphrodite, whatever she's done in the past, turning off the world just didn't work. And she says to herself, Stryker, now it's up to you. And that's how the first volume ends. So clearly whatever future Aphrodite thought she was going to accomplish by traveling back in time and blowing up these certain campuses of technology companies and then shutting down the World Wide Web and shutting off the power didn't work. And to be fair, I don't know why she thinks that it would. I mean, maybe if you did a little more surgical strikes, you could have pushed it off longer. But I just believe that there, when we reach certain points in history, we reach certain technological thresholds, certain other future technologies become inevitable. And I think the other mistake she made is in turning off power. You can't just turn off the whole power grid for the whole world and expect people aren't going to just do whatever they have to do to get that back on. People have learned to rely on it. You know, our lights and our heaters in the wintertime and our air conditioner in the summertime. I mean, that's not something that we're going to give up lightly. If she just had turned off the web or certain aspects of technology, maybe. But the problem is there's too much power there. There's too much dependence. There's too much reliance. You know, we've gotten too used to it. Our phones have become part of us. Social media has become part of us. It's been shown in studies about the way social media and the way our phones affect our biology and our brains now. It's become ingrained in us. And it's too hard to just say, okay, I'm just going to shut this off cold turkey. And then that's going to change things. I don't know. I think it was a flawed plan to begin with. And I don't know. I just think maybe she should have had a better plan. The other aspect of the story I haven't talked about, and I said I would, is the whole idea. And this is a question that goes back far, far, far into the past, before we're even talking necessarily about technology. And it certainly comes to mind with that quote about I'm become life, the savior of worlds that's juxtaposed against I've become death, the destroyer of worlds, Robin Oppenheimer, atomic bomb, and the fact that scientists far too often, or you know, even if you want to go from, you know, before people were considered scientists, but people that that made decisions and explored, and so often it was, you know, human curiosity and the challenge of humanity that seems inherent in us, asking ourselves the question, can I do this? Can I climb that mountain? Can I find a shorter passage to India? Can I discover, new lands? Can I create an atomic bomb? Can I split an atom? All these questions. Can I create technology that where I can make somebody look like somebody else? You know, this deep fake technology that's coming out now where you basically digitize somebody's face over your own, and all of a sudden any video you see, any news report you see, is it real? Is it not? I mean, you already have people that think the moon landing was created on a sound studio somewhere in California. So all these questions of can I, Let me challenge myself. Can I do this? Can I do that? Is it possible? As opposed to asking the question that maybe it should always start with, that's always been a kind of an ethical and moral question, and I feel like it will continue to be for the rest of time, for as long as humanity exists. And that's instead of, or before you ask the question of, can I do something? The question of, should I? Should I split an atom? Should I create deep fake technology? Should I settle this new land that I discovered where there's already people? What gives me the right to take over this land? There's already people here. And it's a valid question. You know, so often people ask themselves, can I do this? I'm going to challenge myself to figure it out. Want that sense of accomplishment, set my mind to it. There's that thing in me that wants to overcome the obstacles and succeed in whatever goal I've put before myself. Not thinking about the ramifications. And again, I'm not saying it's inherently evil for people to do this or wrong or bad, but you always have to think about the consequences after. If I figure out how to split an atom, what are the implications? I don't own this. I don't control this. You know, it's very, very, very rare for somebody to have the ability and the means to fund all the research and all the infrastructure and everything that's necessary in order to do what's necessary in order to accomplish one of these kind of experiments or goals, right? So, you know, usually it's only governments, large entities that can afford to fund this sort of research and development and experiments and whatnot. And so then the person that maybe did ask themselves or should have asked themselves, should I do this rather than just can I do this? They don't actually own what they've created or what they've discovered. And so then it becomes a case of you asked yourself if you could do it and you did it. But now you got to ask yourself what's possible with what I've discovered or what I've uncovered or what I've created, because now it's out of your hands. Now the can of worms has been opened and you can't unring that bell, not to mix my metaphors, but you know, so can I split the atom and produce tremendous amounts of energy? Can we figure out a way to do that, to have a controlled nuclear explosion? Yeah, we can. Look, we figured it out. Should we have? I don't know. Maybe we shouldn't have. But it doesn't matter now because we did it, and now governments of the world have control over it, right? And even now we're still struggling, trying to prevent certain governments that we don't trust, don't feel comfortable with them having the abilities. We're trying to keep it out of their hands, right? We're trying to keep them from the ability to build nuclear weapons. And then when you even take governments out and go a step lower, you start talking about terrorist organizations. You know, if there are certain terrorist organizations who had the ability and the means to create atomic weapons, they could start a nuclear war, right? So if you go back to the very beginnings of it and have the people that started it all off ask themselves the question, should we do this? If it were possible to show them the world as it is now, look at the future and see, hey, this is what could happen if you don't ask yourself the question, should we figure this out? And that's really what Aphrodite has tried to do, right? Future Aphrodite, she's tried to go back in the past because she knows the future. She's trying to go back in the past and prevent it. But again, I don't think she was surgical enough, and she was too broad in what she tried to do, and ultimately has failed, but is hoping that the knowledge that Stryker has, this distrust he inherently has for CDI, and the fact that he knows that she herself came back from the future, and that must be bad. The future must be bad if Aphrodite has flipped and changed sides, and hopefully it'll be enough for him to, for Stryker to try to find the answers and prevent her future from happening. But then the whole thing, and this always comes back to time travel, then the whole thing, well, if he does stop it, then she would never have existed in that state that she existed when she came back in the first place, because she wouldn't have been necessary for her to come back because Stryker would have fixed it. But then if Stryker fixes it and that future version of Aphrodite doesn't exist, she doesn't come back to tell Stryker about it, to motivate him to fix it, so then it doesn't get fixed. Yeah, it's a paradox. It's the reason time travel doesn't really work. Not a fan of it. Can't think about it too hard. But all that being said, there is aspects of this story that's the big summer blockbuster action-packed popcorn movie. And I've talked a little bit about the Attilio Rojo art throughout. I think he does a great job of giving us that action. There are a few times where I wish the panels were a little smaller, which is not always the case. You know, there's plenty of times where I love seeing big panels because it lets us see the art in detail. And I love that. And Rojo's art deserves to be seen in you know, fine detail. But it makes for less story when you have fewer panels, obviously. And these do read pretty quickly. And so I do wish we got a little bit more more story per issue, but especially if you pick up the trade, it's a big chunk of story, and it's a great start to the series. And I think you're being respectful, and you're bringing in elements of that original Cyberforce series that I talked about, where it is very much an action romp, and you don't have to think about it too closely. And if you want to read this story just on that surface level, where it's action packed and time travel and cyborgs and all that kind of stuff, you certainly can. But there are these other aspects that Hawkins and Hill have introduced that are very interesting. You know, this idea of transhumanism, this idea of should you do something versus can you do something, and that whole aspect of technology and how it's taken over our lives. And it's certainly relevant when you talk about things like the internet and social media and smartphones and Alexas in every room of our house and that sort of thing. So great start to the series. I do hope we get the second half of the series. Like I said, I think originally Matt had said it was planned for 25 issues and we've only gotten 11 so far. So hopefully we see the return of it at some point. So anyway, that's going to do it for this episode of the Top Cow Thursday, everybody. So really appreciate you joining us as always, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.